That's true. The state sentence is currently under appeal, so she hasn't begun serving that time. However, in federal court, the judge could sentence her to up to 2 additional years in federal prison.
For having violated what she was doing under supervision, though she did not know it was wrong, thought it was a citizen's
right.
duty?
Right. That's correct. For having a new conviction for voting.
Crystal, do you ever plan to vote again?
I do, and that's what I'm encouraging my kids to get out there so we can make a difference right now. I do. I just feel right now that the system failed me. You get out, you rehabilitate yourself, you get a good job, you go to school, you graduate from school, you're doing everything right. So why would I go and vote to go back to prison? Why would I do something like that to lose my kids again, to start all over again, you know? Through all of this, I lost a good job. Through all of this, so it's like I'm going backwards instead of forward.
Crystal Mason, we have to leave it there. I want to thank you and Kim Cole and Mark Maurer. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
Tune in on August 31st at 8 p.m. to celebrate the queer programmers and the queer community of KBOO as part of our 50th anniversary. Emma Lugo of Transpositive will host this special on-air program. You can join us that night at the Queer Community Open House here at KBOO at 20 Southeast Avenue from 7 to 10 p.m. on August 31st. More information about the Queer Community Open House and anniversary programming is available at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the 13th annual Dancing in the Square American Indian Day Celebration Powwow on Friday, September 7th from noon to 7 p.m. at Pioneer Courthouse Square in Portland. American Indian Day is a traditional showcase and celebration of American Indian and Alaskan Native cultures and community, which raises awareness concerning the challenges that Native American people face in this country. This event features vendors, educational booths, food, entertainment, and more. Again, that's Dancing in the Square American Indian Day Celebration Powwow on Friday, September 7th from noon to 7 p.m. at Pioneer Courthouse Square, 700 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from Oregon Symphony, located at 909 Southwest Washington Street in downtown Portland, presenting Gary Trudeau, political cartoonist and creator of Doonesbury Comics, sharing from his latest book, Sad, Doonesbury and the Time of Trump, Tuesday, October 16th at 7:30 p.m. Tickets and more information available by phone at 503-228-1353 or online at orsymphony.org.
This is Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and this is KBOO Portland.
So your brother's bound and gagged, and they've chained him to a chair. Won't you please come to Chicago just to sing? Land that's known as freedom, how can such a thing be fair? Won't you please come to Chicago for the help that we can bring? We can change the world. We are ready. Sit yourselves down, there's nothing for you here. Won't you please come to
When I was a boy, I wanted to be a policeman in my community, to wear a star and a uniform, and have a car with a big loud horn. This was the life for me, I thought, back when I was a boy. I went to school and studied hard. I wanted to learn the rules to guard. When I grew up, they let me in and gave me a place as one of them. I had reached my lifelong plan to become a policeman. My first real job was the big convention the Democrats held for their nomination. There was trouble expected, we knew, from hippies and yippies and communists too. They'd take over and vowed they would. They were after our blood. The hippies were dirty, the yippies were vile, the commies were there to keep them riled. The mayor didn't want Chicago ruined, and that's what they were intent on doing. They hate America and all that's good, but they call it love. They raised the flag of the Viet Cong. How could these kids have gone so wrong? To aid the Cong who's killing their brothers, destroying us from within our borders. They hit us in waves with their weapons of war. With spikes, bottles, blades, our flesh they tore. We herded them on down Michigan Ave. It's a good thing riot equipment we have. We were trained to handle such mobs. That is part of our job. Police brutality was their moan, joined by announcers for the viewers at home. They know police have got to go, so their leaders can seize control. We do our job the best we can as Chicago policemen. Your help to the police is really needed if the laws are to be heeded. Mobs like these we can't let roam to ruin our country, churches and homes. Americans all across the land, support your local policeman.
Yeah, all right. Harry Burgess, everybody. Harry Burgess, Chicago policeman. Anybody out there heard that song? It's a new one on me. I was, just Googling songs about Chicago 1968. And, of course, we had to hear a little bit of a CSNY. Chicago brings back, brings goosebumps, kind of. We can change the world, rearrange the world, it's dying. Anyway, so yeah, those, anybody who thinks that the extreme social divisions that seem to be manifested now are anything terribly new, all you gotta do is hark back to 1968 or 1492 or 1863 or pick a year, any year. Okay, so yesterday, 1968, at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, tens of thousands of Vietnam War yesterday, on the date of yesterday in 1968, I should be clear, of protesters battle police in the streets while the Democratic Party falls apart over an internal disagreement concerning its stance on Vietnam. Over the course of 24 hours, the predominant American line of thought on the Cold War with the Soviet Union was shattered. Well, a little dramatic there. This comes from Encyclopedia Britannica, something like that. Since the end of World War II, the U.S. perspective on the Soviet Union and Soviet-style communism... Wow, this is a kind of weird take on this. I just wanted some... Meanwhile, in the streets of Chicago, several thousand anti-war protesters gathered to show their support for McCarthy, that's Eugene McCarthy, and the U.S. withdrawal of troops from Vietnam. Chicago Mayor Richard Daley deployed 12,000 police officers and called in another 15,000 state and federal officers to contain the protesters. The situation then rapidly spiraled out of control, with the policemen severely beating and gassing the demonstrators, as well as newsmen and doctors who had come to help. The ensuing riot, known as the Battle of Michigan Avenue, which was referred to in that song, was caught on television and sparked a large-scale change in American society. Maybe. For the first time, many Americans came out in virulent opposition to the Vietnam War, which they'd begun to feel was pointless and wrongheaded. That's an interesting take, because there's many takes on that. In fact, the arguments roil to this day. In These Times had a whole section on various interpretations of Chicago 68. Did it lead to Nixon's election? Did it indeed lead to greater opposition to the Vietnam War? Did it lead to greater fractionization within the, quote, movement? Have any of these conflicts actually been seriously addressed and resolved? My point is, no, they don't get addressed and resolved. Heck, we still haven't dealt with the fallout from the Second International, 1889 to 1916, let alone the split between the Yippies and the Moeb, or between eventually who became the Weather Underground and the more less adventurous, less radical elements of the movement. Violence, nonviolence, stuff goes round and around and around. And meanwhile, the climate is spiraling out of control. We've got fascism on the rise around the world. We've got, of course, Trump and his cronies in power. Excuse this noise, I got to lower this microphone a little bit. Didn't make any noise. Yeah, so here we are talking about all this stuff. 503-231-8187. You can join in the conversation. Maybe you want to talk about something else. That could be all right, too. But, yeah, I don't know if you heard Democracy Now! Yesterday, they had Bobby Seale, Bernadine Dorn, Bill Ayers on to talk about Chicago 1968. And I knew it was coming up, but it reminded me that it was indeed exactly 50 years ago. And, of course, we're celebrating our 50th anniversary here at KBOO Radio. A lot happened in 1968. Hard to imagine. I was not really conscious at the time. I was actually living in the Philippines, strangely enough. My dad worked for a strange story, United States Information Agency, doing American propaganda over there. Could talk about that. Probably not that interesting. So yeah, the Second International, it ended up breaking up over the, partly, largely over the split between libertarian versus authoritarian socialism. Anarchists were largely excluded from the Second International. See, this stuff is just nothing new under the sun. We just keep sweeping all these internal social tensions and conflicts under the rug until they explode. And then, of course, we just split off, people split off, the socialists from the communists, the Trotskyists from the Stalinists, or Leninists, it just goes round and round, and we don't get the social force necessary to actually impede the onslaught of the war machine and the technological juggernaut, which is eating the planet alive. So, yeah, Chicago 1968. Were you there? What do you remember it? What are the relevances for what's going on today? What about the sense of urgency that impelled some of those people to take such extreme action, given the grinding war in Vietnam, the use of napalm, the carpet bombing, the just daily images of death and destruction on television, which played such an important role, and is, of course, why wars don't tend to be covered so intensively by the media anymore. They just tend to grind on and on and on and on and on over in Afghanistan or Iraq or wherever. And of course, the number of American bases, the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, hasn't diminished. But there are cracks in the empire. It's just, I think what happens is people basically, the Trumpistas, you know, it's to admit that this entire American project has flaws from the very beginning is too much. Looks like we got a caller, but let me just finish that thought. I think that's a big part of it, is that it's just too much. I think we all have that in us. I think it's too much to admit that this American way of life that we are so enmeshed in, much as we might criticize or disagree, are we really willing to do what it takes to give it up, abandon it, destroy it, so the world can live? I don't know. Am I? Are any of us? Joe Uris on Tuesday Talk Radio, yesterday, talked about defending the American way of life. I assume he wasn't talking about, you know, the gross consumption and militarism, but was talking about, I guess, some sort of political principles, some sort of institutional framework, constitutional framework. I assume that must have been what he's mentioning. But do we really want to defend or maintain the American way of life? He actually used that phrase. Maybe he's listening. Anyway, we do have a caller. James, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I just a short sidetrack talking about Joe Uris at Abe and Joe radio show. You know, I've called in and talked to them so many times. And, you know, I think the one thing that really escapes them is understand, you know, because they, I feel like sometimes they kind of toe the line of, you know, we need to come together, we need to come across divisive lines. But, you know, and that sounds all good and great, but, you know, ultimately it has to come with serious introspection and self-examination, because, you know, and getting to the point that I wanted to get to, you know, the reason why we can't come together is because, you know, the people who have the most affected power to change, aka white people, they don't want to examine the power, a lot, at least in the mainstream thought, don't want to examine how just their very existence plays into the power structure. They want black and brown people to try and come across racially divided lines, but every time we've done that in the past, we always get left behind. I mean, right now is a really dire time, I agree, but it's only been dire for those in power for a short time, whereas the rest of us have had to kind of languish in, I hesitate to say obscurity because it's not really obscure, but in the background, you know, we black and brown women have always towed the line in terms of, like, you know, being the biggest proponents of civil unrest and civil rights moving forward. And, you know, and black and brown men, really, we have a long ways to come up in terms of trying to really support them. But, you know, it's like it's so hard to talk about coming together when we just, you know, it's like we're just trying to save ourselves right now. And I don't know, you know, and really thinking about, you know, the type of civil unrest we had then, we're not taught that we have civic responsibility, because in those days they actually taught civic classes. They taught how government worked. They taught about the type of rights that we have as citizens, you know, even under the empire as it is. And I think that's a lot of the reason why they don't teach it anymore, because, you know, they don't want these young kids to start thinking that they can have a change outside of what is possible within the empire infrastructure. And not only that, they've effectively cut arts programs, which are really subjugating spontaneity and creative thought outside of the test that they want to teach our kids how to be just button pushers.
Yeah, well, I wonder about that civics education. I don't know specifically that much about it. I certainly know that it, you know, in the 50s there is certainly not a lot of widespread civic resistance. So there seemed to be something about the period of the 1960s that seemed to spur. And whether it was, you know, Vietnam, whether it was the example of the civil rights movement, whether it was, you know, name and a number of other things, I think there's something, there's certainly a spirit of the times, and we can't unfortunately summon up a new spirit of the times. The spirit of the times is what we got. But yeah, I think, go ahead.
I was going to say, you know, I think part of it is, you know, the voices, you know, the American mainstream had done a very good job up until probably the late 50s, early 60s of silencing or obscuring dissenting voices. You know, you notice how a lot of the culture and how a lot of things surrounding in that time were, you know, it's almost kind of, you know, they Norman Rockwell, if you will, is very, you know, white idyllic. You know, there's always this sense of everything's fine, but, you know, it was all gilded. You know, when, you know, people think that, you know, Medgar Evers and Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King, they all just kind of came out of left field, but those were the things that were building in the obscuring that they were keeping out of the mainstream for so long. And I think that the voice finally got loud enough that it just broke through that facade. And it encouraged a lot of other people to stand up too, to really take stock and inventory of what it really means to be an American. Like you said, you know, this American project, it was flawed from the beginning because it was built on a lie.
Well, listen, we got a couple other callers. So I always appreciate your perspective and your comments. And I thank you for calling in, James. And we got Harry up next. Go ahead, Harry.
Oh, Hi, Paul. Thank you for taking my call. You were talking about 1968. Yeah, it was a tumultuous year. I remember it started off with the Tet Offensive, and that put people on notice. And when they saw it on TV, the fighting and all the things were going on, even though we did stop their offensive, but when the U.S. military realized they could put up a Tet Offensive every year for the next 10 years, they kind of knew that we couldn't win this war.
Mm-hmm.
And when Martin Luther King was assassinated, there were riots in 125 cities. And when Robert Kennedy was assassinated, they weren't any riots until the Democratic Chicago convention, because they put in Hubert Humphrey. You know, everyone expected, you know, Robert Kennedy to be the next president. And when he was assassinated, people just didn't know how to react until the Democratic National Convention, and when they were trying to do, when they put Hubert Humphrey in there.
Yeah, in fact, you know, reading about that time, is Kennedy actually created an interesting dynamic, because it actually, I was reading a biography of Abby Hoffman, and they actually kind of backed off. You know, certainly the Chicago protest would not have happened if Kennedy was in there, because he actually got enough support even from the radical faction, because he was such a, you know, a clearly self-proclaimed anti-war candidate. Plus, you know, he was seemed to be coming around on civil rights and other issues that were really important to, you know, the very variegated forces of the movement. And so yeah, his death actually set the stage for the Chicago protests in a major way, I think.
Yeah, and one thing what Robert Kennedy is mostly known for now is the war against poverty. When he went down to, I think it was St. Louis, Mississippi, subway, and they showed how the kids were living and how, you know, they had bloated bellies like they had in Africa. And he went to Appalachia, and it was the same way. We had a huge poverty problem. I mean, people were dying of malnutrition and things like that. And he finally brought it up that we need a war against poverty. Well, Soviet Union and everything else who had this type of socialist government didn't have such people, didn't starve to death. I ran to a few Russians and stuff like that. I said, yeah, we were hungry, but we never starved to death. I mean, so... same thing in China. I mean, hopefully governments can be you know, get together our intellect and everything through government can solve all these type of problems. But yeah, in America, with all our wealth and people were actually starving to death.
Well, unfortunately, Russia and China had their own internal problems in terms of authoritarianism and their own problems of, you know, the contradictions of industrial expansion and competition on the world stage, and also their own, you know, imperialist tendencies. And
yeah,
so, yeah,
definitely, they were totalitarian. There's no doubt about that. And you know, but,
yeah, whether or not, you know, they could have gone in a different direction. Well, maybe if the Second International hadn't broken up over the question of libertarian versus authoritarian socialism, maybe history could have gone differently.
Mm-hmm.
Think about that. Anyway, I appreciate your call as always.
Okay, thank you very much for taking my call.
All right, Chicago, 1968. You know, this brings up all sorts of interesting questions, and I like to talk about these historical issues, you know, the importance of actually confronting these divisions, both broader divisions in society between the, you know, the Trump and the anti-Trump, between the law and order policeman exemplified in an ironic way by Harry Burgess, you know, who was just on his first assignment as a Chicago policeman, and he got the, if you heard the opening song, got the job of going against the yippies and the hippies and the commies at the Chicago National Democratic Convention. Anyway, we have another caller, and you can join the conversation by going to 503-231-8187, coming up on 8:30 in the morning, and we got Edie. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah. You're on the air.
Okay, so I would like everybody to go to City of Portland City Council, copy-paste the email address of the mayor and the City Council members and send them a quick email that they can supposedly read before they start the City Council meeting that starts at 9:30. And if you can, show up at 9:30. If you can only show up, drop off a piece of paper and go, take it to the clerk's office and say why you oppose item number 918 and item 919 had to do with your opening call song about the police. One is to have the City of Portland ever yet get even more money, Portland Police get even more money, over $10,000, to do biometric screening so they can find out more about protesters and other activists.
Wasn't there a big issue over this biometric screening at the end of one of those Antifa Patriot Prayer protests where they're taking everybody's idea?
Okay, this is like where you photo, where they have on the cop cars, on the cops and everything, facial recognition software.
Right, right. No, I'm just making a comment that it would be even easier for them to do that sort of thing if they had even more extensive...
I want them to... are you there?
Yeah, of course I'm here, yes.
I want them to... No, I'm having a phone problem, sorry. I want you all to tell them, don't give the Portland Police even more money to have more fascist control over us and silence dissent. And then item 918 or 919 is about giving even more money to the Portland Police working with the armed PSU police that murdered a black man who had stopped a fight. The PSU campus security were off of campus and murdered a man who was out in the City of Portland off of campus. So we need to say no to giving even more and more money almost every week to the Portland Police Bureau and hold them accountable.
Hold on. So what's the nature of this 919? In what way would they work more closely with the PSU police?
I'm going to go take care of a little lady right now. But so I want you to look on Portland City Council, get their emails, look at the Portland City Council agenda. Item 918 and 919 want you to be able to testify. You have 60 seconds to testify in person, or you send an email or a quick note to tell them you're opposed to giving more money to the Portland Police for biometric software from the state of police and PSU security. I'm sorry, okay. I got to go take care of this lady.
Okay,
bye.
Great. Thanks, Edie. And so that's coming up in an hour for those of you who are able to get down there. That's at City Hall, Portland. And that's an encouragement to engage with the civic process here in Portland. And as Edie said, you could also go to their website, the Portland City Council, and look up their agenda for this morning and look up these two agenda items, 918 and 919, both having to do with the Portland Police, the biometric technology, which I was trying to mentioned that there, you know, there's an issue after a protest last year, I believe, where they took everybody's information, and they shouldn't have. At the end of a protest, they had everybody line up and they took photos of their IDs and stuff. So I was just saying that this sounds like it just adds capacity to their ability to monitor people before, during, and after such events. So Edie quite rightly points out that they don't need more capacity to monitor us. They need to monitor the out of control elites who are destroying the world. But to get the police to go against their paycheck, essentially, is a tall order. Looks like we got one more coming up. Dave hung up. If you want to call back, call 503-231-8187. It looks like we got a clean slate. So if you've been wanting to talk on the radio, just itching to talk on the radio, and just never got around to it or got cold feet or whatever, this is your opportunity. Let's see, coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 on Political Perspectives, Lisa Loving is here live and welcomes one of the founders of Kairos PDX, the Portland Charter School, dedicated to overcoming the racial achievement gap. You may have heard, I believe they're wanting to evict that school. I could have that wrong, but so check that out coming up in just a half an hour with Lisa Loving. At 10, Air Cascadia headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And 11, Project Censored features a recent speech by legendary activist Ralph Nader, who says one person can make a difference. And all of these KBOO programs are made possible by members' support. That means you, or it could mean you, if it doesn't mean you. If you would like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. Yeah. My name is Paul Rowland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. And 503-231-8187. Yeah, I was saying there's still debate over the Chicago convention protests. Probably most young people don't know much about it. But yeah, these Antifa and Trumpista, or a Patriot Prayer, whoever they might be, neo-fascists, alt-right sorts of people in the Antifa, anti-fascists, civil libertarians, anti-racists, other people who gather at these sometimes very conflictual protests certainly echo what was happening in the 1960s, where, you know, you had the stereotypical image of the construction worker, for some reason became a kind of a trope or a meme, the hard hat going after the, you know, the Teamster types, going after the hippies and the yippies. You know, the film Easy Rider, the conflict between the long hairs and the straights, or the, you know, in that film, I guess the, to some extent, the Southern redneck, the image of the Texas cop and the long hair, the fighting in the streets, which wasn't just between the police and the protesters, but yes, there were conservatives. Got an article here I want to read a little bit from. Why Trump supporters believe he is not corrupt. In the Atlantic, just came out about a week ago, in fact, just a week ago. On Wednesday morning, the lead story on FoxNews.com was not Michael Cohen's admission that Donald Trump had instructed him to violate campaign finance laws by paying hush money to two of Trump's mistresses. It was the alleged murder of a white Iowa woman, Molly Tibbetts, by an undocumented Latino immigrant, Christian Rivera. On their face, the two stories have little in common. Fox is simply covering the Iowa murder because it distracts attention from a revelation that makes Trump look bad. But dig deeper and the two stories are connected. They represent competing notions of what corruption is. Cohen's admission highlights one of the enduring riddles of the Trump era. Trump supporters say they care about corruption. During the campaign, they cheered his vow to drain the swamp in Washington, D.C. When Morning Consult asked Americans in May 2016 to explain why they disliked Hillary Clinton, the second most common answer was that she was corrupt. And yet, Trump supporters appear largely unfazed by the mounting evidence that Trump is the least ethical president in modern American history. When asked last month whether they considered Trump corrupt, only 14% of Republicans said yes. Even Cohen's allegation is unlikely to change that. The answer may lie in how Trump and his supporters define corruption. In a forthcoming book entitled How Fascism Works, the Yale philosophy professor Jason Stanley makes an intriguing claim. Corruption to the fascist politician, he suggests, is really about the corruption of purity rather than of the law. Officially, the fascist politician's denunciations of corruption sound like a denunciation of political corruption. But such talk is intended to evoke corruption in the sense of the usurpation of the traditional order. Fox's decision to focus on the Iowa murder rather than Cohen's guilty plea illustrates Stanley's point. In the eyes of many Fox viewers, I suspect, the network isn't ignoring corruption so much as highlighting the kind that really matters. When Trump instructed Cohen to pay off women with whom he'd had affairs, he may have been violating the law, but he was upholding traditional gender and class hierarchies. Since time immemorial, powerful men have been cheating on their wives and using their power to evade the consequences. The Iowa murder, by contrast, signifies the inversion, the corruption of that traditional order. Throughout American history, few notions have been as sacrosanct as the belief that white women must be protected from non-white men. By allegedly murdering Tibbetts, Rivera did not merely violate the law, he did something more subversive. He violated America's traditional racial and sexual norms. Once you grasp that for Trump and many of his supporters, corruption means less the violation of law than the violation of established hierarchies, their behavior makes more sense. Since 2014, Trump has employed the phrase rule of law 9 times in tweets. Seven of them refer to illegal immigration. Why were Trump's supporters so convinced that Clinton was the more corrupt candidate, even as reporters uncovered far more damning evidence about Trump's foundation than they did about Clinton's? Likely because Clinton's candidacy threatened traditional gender roles. For many Americans, female ambition, especially in service of a feminist agenda, in and of itself represents a form of corruption. When female politicians were described as power-seeking, noted the Yale researchers Victoria Breskel and Tyler Okamoto in a 2010 study, participants experienced feelings of moral outrage, i.e. contempt, anger, and/or disgust. Cohen's admission makes it harder for Republicans to claim that Trump didn't violate the law, but it doesn't really matter. For many Republicans, Trump remains uncorrupt, indeed anti-corrupt, because what they fear most isn't the corruption of American law, it's the corruption of America's traditional identity. And in the struggle against that form of corruption, the kind embodied by Christian Rivera, Trump isn't the problem, he's the solution. Yes, I think that speaks exactly to what I was trying to get at. You know, we too often live in our bubbles, you know, whether it's kind of a liberal Portland bubble, a KBOO bubble, you know, a Bernie bubble, a anti-Trump bubble, an Antifa bubble. I think, and it's, you know, it's some in some ways too easy to go to war against these purists, these defenders of the traditional American way. What the solution is, we seem to be unable, increasingly unable, to actually come together in any real forum to hash these out, let alone the fallout from the 1968 Democratic Convention protests, or the fallout from the Second International, or the fallout from the colonization of America, the fallout from slavery. We seem to be unable to deal with generally the fallout from these deep, deep contradictions, conflicts, divisions. The lone try to overcome our own internal personal conflicts, which may prevent us from looking further abroad, our own assumptions. Yeah, so I think this is really very fascinating. You know, this Trump tweeting about, I mean, essentially white genocide is essentially what he's tweeting about. I've talked about this, that, you know, in South Africa, this idea that there's this massive violent backlash against white people, against the, you know, former beneficiaries of apartheid, such that they're just massively taking over the land, which is, you know, essentially what land reform is redistribution of land. And I think that's a good thing. But this idea, this trope that there's this, it's happening on a large scale in South Africa, and that whites are being killed by blacks. I think the astounding thing to me is that didn't happen more as the apartheid system broke up. I would expect people would have been just more vengeful. In fact, it was a rather relatively peaceful transition. And in fact, they've done less than they could and probably should have done in reversing the, you know, decades and decades of economic and other inequality in South Africa, and left largely a lot of the white ownership of land and means of production intact, probably bending over backwards not to antagonize the white supremacist powers that be in the world. Anyway, so yeah, Trump is there tweeting about that. Obviously, he felt the need to you know, reassure his alt-right supporters, the supporters of purity. Brings up the old Dr. Strangelove movie, that code for the being able to unlock the general said of unleashing the nuclear bombers in that film, Dr. Strangelove. Anyway, the code to be able to break through that was POE, or purity of essence. Maybe you remember that. Anyway, I'm just talking to myself. We only got 15 minutes left. 503-231-8187. Please call in. I hope this has been somewhat interesting. I find it endlessly fascinating, this perverse culture that we live in. I kind of want to talk about denialism as well. You know, I talked about the urgent situation of climate change last week. So it's just astounding to me that we could be in a situation where we really do risk heading towards, you know, in a possibly much shorter time than we even can imagine, of accelerating the heating of this precious biosphere that we live in. Anyway, it's just endlessly shocking to me that we can't seem to break through the spell. And I think there's a kind of denialism that's way deeper than we even imagine, which is the kind of denialism of this bedrock, you know, white supremacist purity and gender purity and patriarchal purity, which is, you know, waning in its influence. And part of the problem is in its waning of its influence and in the demographic shift where the white majority is losing its majority, that the feeling of loss of identity, like the, you know, how the apartheid regime became more and more vicious and just did just astoundingly genocidal things, as it was increasingly obvious they couldn't maintain that system. You know, here, and the, we've had a white majority for so long due to the, you know, the demographic collapse and genocide of Native people and the demographic, huge demographic boom as we, you know, the frontier was expanded. That's been the buttress in this country, is the huge white population. And as that slips, obviously it's creating a crisis in identity and psychology of the, you know, white and largely male population, which leads to phenomenon like the alt-right and the Patriot Prayer and all that. So, but it's not automatic, you know, that this demographic shift, maybe some people thought it was sort of this automatic process would just sort of take over, but obviously that's not happening. In fact, sort of the backlash of its demise is creating, you know, Donald Trump as president. All right, well, we only have about 10 minutes left. 503-231-8187. These are some of the things I'm thinking about. Denialism, I was going to, you know, I think there's actually even a deeper levels of denialism at work, as I said, about, you know, can't admit that this American way of life has to change dramatically in a such at a speed that is highly improbable, if not necessarily impossible, in order to stave off total climate catastrophe and perhaps even to stave off a total social devolution. You know, who knows what sort of machinations. You know, we sort of have this touching faith in the institutional framework. You know, it was kind of like, you know, the Supreme Court, you know, would sort of check and, you know, create checks and balances that, you know, that it seems like the people have this faith that the process is now reining in Trump. Could be. Maybe it'll work. Whether the constitutional framework is actually really the best framework is another, because so many, it's like, you know, these Russian dolls or whatever, nested one inside the other. And where does it all begin? Anyway, so that's what I'm thinking about is this culture of purity, which is being threatened and which is disappearing, but yet the backlash is creating certainly tremendous difficulty of actually dealing with the very real world problems, let alone these sort of psychocultural issues that have plagued this nation. Looks like we might have a phone caller. Okay, Helen, go ahead. Hi. Join the conversation. Hi.
Yeah, well, I was feeling a little sorry for you. No calls. And I thought, okay, I'm going to call. So I'm going to take this to a tiny level. And that is that getting rid of plastic bags. Corvallis did it, and McMinnville was doing it. But you would not believe the kicking and screaming of managers of, like, Safeway
or Albertsons. All these things have been going on, and so what's happened, they finally got a code enforcement person, but it really is just on that tiny level that people can't think about changing their attitude and bringing their bags in. And now I was in Salem yesterday, and I'm just like almost offended by having them giving me a plastic bag because I've gotten so used to not getting them. And they said Salem's going to probably do it too. And so the next one will be hopefully Portland. And that's one way of getting people to try to make a change, but it's very, very difficult. You know, they don't think about all the plastics in the oceans, and they're not thinking outside their own little world. But partly, maybe it's because they're so overwhelmed in life. I mean, everything is spinning so fast.
I think it's corruption myself. I think convenience. I think we've been corrupted by the ease of fossil fuels and all these amazing products. But yeah, I think it's a form of corruption.
Well, okay, but it's overwhelming in the lives of people, just even having their children. I know out in the country, there's the, you know, people, well, school's about ready to start. So before that, everybody's out with their kids, you know, three or four kids. And I think to myself, aren't they thinking about things? They're not thinking about things. And think about in the 60s. I mean, people did think about not having many children. And there was a certain amount of women who didn't have children. But heaven forbid if we'd think about bringing that up.
Yeah, no, there's lots of things that are taboo.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
A lot of things that are, we have a hard time dealing with taboo and with change and with, you know, confronting in some ways our own, how enmeshed, you said overwhelmed. Yeah, we're so enmeshed. And it's just so easy, and we're so dependent that, yeah, it's difficult. We become...
Want to change our pattern. We have a hard time changing a pattern. And it's like, I go to the grocery store, Winco. I'm so proud of people, you know, like older people. You know, everybody's got their bags. And if they don't have their bags, then most often they'll just put their groceries in their cart and put them in their car. And so, you know, that is a good thing. Also, the country, people are not watering their lawns. Everything's brown. I mean, most often they're all brown. And when I was in Salem yesterday, I noticed some green area and they're using the water. And I think, well, why are they doing that? I know they want to make things look good, but it also should be saving the water.
Yeah, as I rode my bike in from Montevilla to the inner southeast Portland where KBOO is in the nice cool morning air, I noticed this at least one house, they had this sprinkler system with a fine mist and must have been about 8 or 10 nozzles in the ground watering the strip between the sidewalk and the street.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
That's
yeah,
pretty strange.
The devil is in the details for sure. Well, thank you for calling that in. And and yeah, we do, the devil is in the details. It's often in the smallest things.
Well, the other thing I want to say is there was a meeting with the legislators in Salem, and they say that with the way things are going, by 2050, there will not be any more fir trees. They'll all die, because it's going to be getting so dry. And so already out in the country, people are planting olive trees.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought I'd let you know that.
All right. Well, thank you for that. And we got a Mark coming up next. Go ahead, Mark. You're on the air.
Good morning, Paul. Thanks for your truth-telling and your passion and your struggle against the fossil fools. I wanted to talk for a minute about victimization. I mean, Trump always stylizes himself as a victim, the victim of the media or the victim of culture wars. And to me, as a German translator, this echoes Hitler, who tried to warn the people. He said international Jewry was exterminating Germany. And so Germans had to be on the defensive, you know, creating a a false threat, and that's what that's what Trump does when he scapegoats and when he presents a bash a smear campaigns against Latinos. If he could only pick lettuce for one morning, I think he'd have a different attitude. Maybe he's really the classic person who has lived in a bubble and who has mistaken wealth for life.
No, I mean, yeah,
for sharing.
One could so psychoanalyze the fool endlessly, and it's obviously, yeah, totally. I mean, he's lived a life of
sharing becomes inefficient or an attack on the system.
Well, sure, but well, you know, the idea of, you know, it brings up the idea of communism, socialism, the idea that actually the individual isn't the be all and end all, that all this psychological pressure on the individual to perform and be able to make it that basically forces people into this ideology of, you know, you have to go it on your own.
And
to give that up is too much. And the idea that, you know, Trump did it on his own is obviously absurd, because he
In truth, financialization is the name of the illness. That money was, you know, trillions were injected into the financial sector to keep it alive. That it's really in the intensive care unit. That's the reality. Corporations spent $480 billion so far this year buying back their own stock. What a strange phenomenon that is.
Yeah, it's casino capitalism. It's the seemingly end stage of capitalism, although people have been predicting the end stage of capitalism or prognosticating on it for quite a while. But this definitely seems like it can't go on much further. One last article I want to mention. There's a UN report that says capitalism must die for the earth to live. It's making the rounds of the internet. I'll try to put up some of these articles on my page here. Last thought, we got to run here.
Okay, there's also a conversation on therealnews.com with Rana Faruhar titled "The Rise of Finance and the Fall of American Business." It's a six section interview, so I recommend it. She really understands how the financial economy is ruining the real economy.
Fair enough. Well, on that note, we got to run. Thank you for calling in. Thank you, everybody else, for calling in. And this has been Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm your host, Paul Rowland. Coming up in just about 2 minutes or so is Lisa Loving, who welcomes one of the founders of Kairos PDX, the Portland Charter School dedicated to overcoming the racial achievement gap. Got to get out of here. Thanks for engineering, Tammy, and be seeing you next week.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of PDX Short Docs on Sunday, September 2nd at 7 p.m. at the Mission Theater in Portland. PDX Short Docs will show multiple short documentaries by local filmmakers, followed by an audience Q&A. There will be films about the Me Too movement, the Palindrome World Championship, an urban farm, the Oregon coast, and much more. Again, that's PDX Short Docs on Sunday, September 2nd at 7 p.m. at the Mission Theater, 1624 Northwest Gleason Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of EFFECT on Thursday and Friday, September 6th and 7th at the University of Oregon White Stag Block in Portland. EFFECT is a two-day conference that examines the work, culture, and design of social change. This grassroots event, featuring stories from multiple marginalized activists, creators, and technologists working towards social change. Again, that's Affect on Thursday and Friday, September 6th and 7th at the University of Oregon, White Stag Block, 70 Northwest Cooch Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hello, Mr. and Mrs. Radioland. I am Eldridge Cleaver, the former Minister of Information of the Black Panther Party. You are listening to KBOO Portland. This is listener-sponsored, non-commercial community radio. I want you to listen to and support KBOO because Portland needs it, you need it, and the world needs it. Ubalagani! Boing, boing.
Yeah, KBOO, it's 9 o'clock. Here's what's coming up for the remainder of the morning. First, on Political Perspectives, today Lisa Loving welcomes one of the founders of Kairos PDX, the Portland Charter School dedicated to overcoming the racial achievement gap. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 o'clock, Project Censored features a recent speech by legendary activist Ralph Nader, who says one person can make a difference. And KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Literary Arts, presenting civil rights activist DeRay McKesson, September 20th at Arlene Snitzer Concert Hall, featuring a conversation on culture, social justice,